I leaned down to grab him and prevent him from leaving, and wearily let myself into the house. It felt a lot quieter and emptier without Mouse in it. Don't get me wrong, me and Mister were roommates for years before the pooch came along, but it had taken considerable adjustments for both of us to get used to sharing our tiny place with a monstrous, friendly dust mop, and the sudden lack of his presence was noticeable and uncomfortable. But Mister idly sauntered over to Mouse's bowl, ate a piece of kibble, and then calmly turned the entire bowl over so that kibble rolled all over the floor of the kitchen alcove. Then he went to Mouse's usual spot on the floor and lay down, sprawling luxuriously. So maybe it was just me. I sat down on the couch, made a call, left a message, and then found myself lacking sufficient ambition to walk all the way into my bedroom, strip the sheets Morgan had bloodied, and put fresh ones on before I slept. So instead I just stretched out on the couch and closed my eyes. Sleep was instantaneous. I didn't so much as stir until the front door opened and Murphy came in, holding the amulet that let her in past my wards. It was morning, and cheerful summer sunlight was shining through my well windows. "Harry," she said, "I got your message." Or at least that's what I think she said. It took me a couple of tries to get my eyes open and sit up. "Hang on," I said. "Hang on." I shambled into the bathroom and sorted things out, then splashed some cold water on my face and came back into the living room. "Right. I think I can sort of understand English now." She gave me a lopsided smile. "You look like crap in the morning." "I always look like this before I put on my makeup," I muttered. "Why didn't you call my cell? I'd have shown up right away." "Needed sleep," I said. "Morning was good enough." "I figured." Murphy drew a paper bag from behind her back. She put it down on the table. I opened it. Coffee and donuts. "Cop chicks are so hot," I mumbled. I pushed Peabody's file across the table to her and started stuffing my face and guzzling. Murphy went through it, frowning, and a few minutes later asked, "What's this?" "Warden case file," I said, "which you are not looking at." "The worm has turned," she said bemusedly. "Why am I not looking at it?" "Because it's everything the council has about Lafortier's death," I said. "I'm hoping something in here will point me toward the real bad guy. Two heads are better than one." "Got it," she said. She took a pen and a notepad from her hip pocket and set them down within easy reach. "What should I be looking for?" "Anything that stands out." She held up a page. "Well, here's something," she said in a dry tone. "The Vic was 279 years old when he died." I sighed. "Just look for inconsistencies." "Ah," she said wisely. Then we both fell quiet and started reading the documents in the file. Morgan had given it to me straight. A few days before, a warden on duty in Edinburgh heard a commotion in Lafortier's chambers. She summoned backup, and when they broke in, they found Morgan standing over Lafortier's still warm corpse holding the murder weapon. He professed confusion and claimed he did not know what had happened. The weapon had been matched to Lafortier's wounds, and the blood had matched as well. Morgan was imprisoned, and a rigorous investigation had turned up a hidden bank account that had just received a cash deposit of a hell of a lot of money. Once confronted with that fact, Morgan managed to escape, badly wounding three wardens in the process.
"Can I ask you something?" Murphy said.
"Sure."
"One of the things that make folks leery of pulling the trigger on a wizard is his death curse, right?"
"Uh-huh," I said. "If you're willing to kill yourself to do it, you can lay out some serious harm on your killer." She nodded.
"Is it an instantaneous kind of thing?"
I pursed my lips.
"Not really." "Then how long does it take? Minutes? Seconds?"
"About as long as it takes to pull a gun and plug somebody," I said. "Some would be quicker than others."
"A second or three, then?"
"Yeah."
"Did Morgan get blasted by Lafortier's death curse, then?"
I lifted an eyebrow.
It's sort of hard to say. It isn't always an immediate effect. Best guess?" I sipped at the last of the coffee.
"Lafortier was a member of the senior council. You don't get there without some serious chops. A violent death curse from someone like that could turn a city block to glass. So, if I had to guess, I'd say no. Lafortier didn't throw it."
"Why not?"
I frowned some more.
He had time enough, Murphy said. There was obviously a struggle. The Vic had defensive wounds all over his arms, and he bled to death. That doesn't take long, but it's plenty of time to do the cursed thing. For that matter, I mused, why didn't either of them use magic? This was a strictly physical struggle. Could their powers have canceled each other out? Technically, I guess, I said. But that sort of thing needs serious synchronization. It doesn't often happen by accident. Well, that's something, then, she said. Both men either chose not to use magic, or else were unable to use magic. Ditto the curse. Either Lafortier chose not to use it, or he was incapable of using it. The question is, why? I nodded. Sound logic. So, how does that help us get closer to the killer? She shrugged, unfazed. No clue. That's how investigation works, most of the time. Cops, detectives, and quixotic wizards hardly ever know which information is pertinent until we've actually got a pretty good handle on what's happening. All you can do is accumulate whatever data you can and hope that it falls into a recognizable pattern. Good thought, but it doesn't help yet, I said. What else have we got? Murphy shook her head. Nothing that I can see yet, but do you want a suggestion? Sure. She held up the page with the details on the incriminating bank account. Follow the money. The money? Witnesses can be mistaken or bought. Theories and deductions can throw you completely off target. She tossed the page back onto the coffee table. But the money always tells you something, assuming you can find it. I picked up the page and scanned it again. A foreign bank, Amsterdam. Can you get them to show you where the payment came from? You're kidding, Murphy said. It would take me days, weeks, maybe months to go through channels and get that kind of information from an American bank, if I could get it at all. From a foreign bank specializing in confidentiality? I'd got a better chance of winning a slam dunk contest against Michael Jordan. I grunted. I got the disposable camera out of my duster pocket and passed it over to Murphy. I snapped some shots of the scene, a lot more of them than there are in the warden's file. I'd like to get your take on them. She took the camera and nodded. Okay, I can take them by a photo center, and my old rotary telephone rang, interrupting her. I held up a hand to her and answered it.
Harry, Thomas said, his voice tight. We need you here, now.
I felt my body thrum into a state of tension. What's happening?
Hurry,
my brother snapped. I can't take them on by... The line went dead.
Oh, God.
I looked up at Murphy, who took one look at my face and rose to her feet, car keys in hand, already moving toward the door. Trouble?
Trouble.
Where? I rose, seizing my staff and blasting rod. Storage rental park off Deerfield Square.
I know it, Murphy said. Let's go.
Chapter 18. The handy part about riding with a cop was that she has the cool toys to make it simpler to get places quickly, even on a busy Chicago morning. The car was still bouncing from sweeping into the street from the little parking lot next to my apartment when she slapped a whirling blue light on the roof and started a siren. That part was pretty neat. The rest of the ride wasn't nearly as fun. Moving fast through a crowded city is a relative term, and in Chicago it meant a lot of rapid acceleration and sudden braking. We went through half a dozen alleys, hopped one bad intersection by driving up over the curb through a parking lot, and swerved through traffic at such a rate that my freshly imbibed coffee and donuts started swirling and sloshing around in a distinctly unpleasant fashion. Kill the noise and light, I said a couple of blocks from the storage park. She did it, asking, why?
Because whatever is there, there's several of them, and Thomas didn't think he could handle them.
I drew my .44 out of my duster pocket and checked it. Nothing's on fire, so let's hope that nothing's gone down yet, and we'll be all sneaky-like until we know what's happening.
Still with the revolvers, Murphy said, shaking her head.
She drove past the street leading to the storage units, and went one block past it instead before she turned and parked.
When are you gonna get a serious gun?
Look, I said, just because you've got twice as many bullets as me.
Three times as many, Murphy said. The SIG holds 20.
20? Look, the point is that, and it reloads a lot faster. You've just got some loose rounds at the bottom of your pocket, right? No speed loader? I stuck the gun back in my pocket and tried to make sure none of the bullets fell out as we got out of the car. That's not the point. Murphy shook her head.
Damn, Dresden.
I know the revolver is going to work, I said, starting toward the storage park. I've seen automatics jam before. New ones? Well, no. Murphy had placed her own gun in the pocket of her light sports jacket. It's a good thing you've got options, that's all I'm saying. If a revolver was good enough for Indiana Jones, I said, it's good enough for me. He was a fictional character, Harry. Her mouth curved up in a small smile. And he had a whip. I eyed her. Her eyes sparkled. Do you have a whip, Dresden? I eyed her even more. Murphy, are you coming on to me? She laughed, her smile white and fierce, as we rounded a corner and found the white rental van where Thomas had left it, across the street from the storage park. Two men in similar gray suits and gray fedoras were standing nonchalantly in the summer morning sunshine on the sidewalk next to the van. On second glance, they were wearing the exact same gray suit and the exact same gray hat, in fact. Feds? I asked Murphy quietly as we turned down the sidewalk. Even feds shop at different stores, she said. I'm getting a weird vibe here, Harry. I turned my head and checked out the storage park through the 10-foot-high metal black fencing that surrounded it. I saw another pair of men in gray suits going down one row of storage units. Two more pairs were on the next, and two more on the one after that. That makes 12, Murphy murmured to me. She hadn't even turned her head. Murphy has cop powers of observation. All in the same suit. Yeah, they're from out of town, I said. A lot of times when beings from the Never Never want to blend in, they pick a look and go with it. I thought about it for a couple of steps. The fact that they all pick the same look might mean they don't have much going for them in the way of individuality. Meaning I'd only have to go on a date with one of them to know about the rest? Murphy asked. Meaning that you need a sense of self to have a sense of self-preservation. Murphy exhaled slowly. That's just great. She moved a hand toward her other pocket where I knew she kept her cell. More manpower might help. Might set them off, too, I said. I'm just saying, if the music starts, don't get soft and shoot somebody in the leg or something. You've seen too many movies, Harry, she said. If cops pull the trigger, it's because they intend to kill someone. We leave the trick shots to SWAT snipers and Indiana Jones. I looked at the booth beside the entrance to the storage park. There was normally an attendant there during the day, but there was no one in the booth. Or in sight on the street, for that matter. Where's your unit? Murphy asked. I waggled my eyebrows at her. Right where it's always been, doll face. She made a noise that sounded like someone about to throw up. First row past the middle, I said. Down at the far end of the park. We have to walk past those two jokers by the van to see it. Yeah, I said. But I don't think these suits have found it yet. They're still here, and still looking. If they had located Morgan, they'd be gone already. As we approached, I noticed that the two tires next to the curb on the white rental van were flat. They're worried about a getaway. Are you sure they aren't human? Murphy asked. Reasonably? She shook her head. Not good enough. Are they from the spirit world or not? Might not be able to tell until we get closer, I said. Might even need to touch one of them. She took a slow, deep breath. As soon as you're certain, she said, tell me. Shake your head if you're sure they aren't human. Nod if you can't tell, or if they are. We were less than 20 feet away from the van, and there was no time to argue or ask questions. Okay. I took a few more steps and ran smack into a curtain of nauseating energy, so thick and heavy that it made my hair stand on end. A dead giveaway of a hostile supernatural presence. I twitched my head in a quick shake as the two men in gray suits spun around at precisely the same time, at precisely the same speed, to face me. Both of them opened their mouths. Before any sound could come out, Murphy produced her sidearm and shot them both in the head. Twice. Double-tapping the target like that is a professional killer's policy. There's a small chance that a bullet to the head might strike a target at an oblique angle and carom him off of the skull. It isn't a huge possibility, but a double tap drops the odds from very unlikely to virtually impossible. Murphy was a cop, and a competition shooter, and less than 5 feet away from her targets. She did the whole thing in one smooth move, the shots coming as a single pulsing hammer of sound. The men in gray suits didn't have time to so much as register her presence, much less do anything to avoid their fate. Clear liquid exploded from the backs of their skulls, and both men dropped to the sidewalk like rag dolls, their bodies and outfits deforming like a snowman in the spring, leaving behind nothing but ectoplasm, the translucent gooey gel that was the matter of the never-never. "Hell's bells," I choked, as my adrenaline spiked after the fact. Murphy kept the gun on the two until it was obvious that they weren't going to take up a second career as headless horsemen. Then she looked up and down the street, her cold blue eyes scanning for more threats as she popped the almost full clip from the SIG and slapped a fully loaded one back in. She may look like somebody's favorite aunt, but Murph can play hardball. A couple of seconds later, what sounded like the howls of a gang of rabid bandsaws filled the air. There were a lot more than 12 of them. "Come on," I shouted and sprinted forward. The gray suits weren't individualists. It wasn't unthinkable that they would possess some kind of shared consciousness. Whacking the lookouts had obviously both alerted and enraged the others, and I figured that they would respond the way any colony consciousness does when one of its members gets attacked. The gray suits were coming to kill us. We couldn't afford to run, not when they were this close to Morgan and Molly, but if the gray suits caught us on the open street, we were hosed. Our only chance was to move forward, fast, to get into the storage park while they went screaming out of it looking for us. If we were quick enough, we might have time to get to the storage unit, collect Morgan and company, and make a quick escape through the portal in the floor and into the Never Never. I pounded across the street and through the entrance, with Murphy on my heels. I threw myself forward as the howls grew louder and made it into the center row just as maybe 20 or 25 gray suits came rushing out of the other rows. Some of them saw us and slammed on the brakes, throwing up gravel with their expensive shoes, putting up a new tone of howl. The others belatedly began to turn as well, and then we were all the way into the center row of storage units, still moving at a dead run. The gray suits rushed after us, but Murphy and I had a good 40-yard lead, and they didn't appear to be superhumanly light on their feet. We were going to make it. Then I remembered that the door to the storage bay was locked shut. I fumbled for the key as I ran, trying to pull it out of the front pocket of my jeans so that it would be ready. I figured that if I didn't get the door unlocked and open on the first try, the gray suits would catch up to us and kill us both. So naturally, I dropped the damn key. I cursed and slid to a stop, slipping on the gravel. I looked around wildly for the dropped key, horribly aware of the mob of gray suits rushing toward us, now in eerie silence. "Harry," Murphy said. "I know." She appeared beside me in a shooting stance, aiming at the nearest gray suit. "Harry, I know." Metal gleamed amongst the gravel, and I swooped down on it as Murphy opened fire with precise, measured shots, sending the nearest gray suit into a tumbling sprawl. The others just vaulted over him and kept coming. I'd found the key, but it was already too late. Neither of us was going to make it to the shelter of my hideaway. Chapter 19. "Stay close," I shouted. I thrust the end of my staff into the gravel and dragged it through, drawing a line in the dust and stones. I swiftly inscribed a quick, rough circle, maybe 4 feet across, around Murphy and me, actually getting between her gun and the gray suits for a second. "Damn it, Harry, get down," she shouted. I did so, reaching out to touch the line in the gravel, slamming a quick effort of will into the simple design. Murphy's gun barked twice. I felt the energy gather in the circle and coalesce in a rush, snapping into place in a sudden and invisible wall. The nearest of the gray suits staggered and then flung itself into a forward dive. Murphy flinched back, and I grabbed her hard before she could cross the circle and disrupt it. The gray suit slammed into the circle as if striking a solid wall, rebounding from its surface in a flash of blue-white light that described a phantom cylinder in the air. An instant later, more of the gray suits did exactly the same thing, maybe 20 of them, each of them bouncing off the circle's field. "Easy," I said to Murphy, still holding her against me. "Easy, easy." I felt her relax a little, ceasing to struggle against being held in place. "It's okay," I said. "As long as we don't break the circle, they can't get through." We were both shaking. Murphy took a pair of gulping breaths. We just stood there for a moment, while the gray suits spread out around the circle, reaching out with their hands to find its edges. I had time to get a better look at them while they did. They were all the same height and weight. Their features were unremarkable and similar, if not quite identical. They looked as if they could have all been from the same family. Their eyes were all the same color, an odd gray-green, and there was no expression, none whatsoever, on their faces. One of them reached out as if to try to touch me, and his open hand flattened against the circle's field. As it did, a freaking mouth opened on his palm, parallel to his fingers. It was lined with serrated shark-like teeth, and a slithering, coiling purple-black tongue emerged to lash randomly against the circle as if seeking a way through. Yellowish mucus dripped thickly from the tongue as it did. "Okay," Murphy said in a small, toneless voice. "That is somewhat disturbing." "And it's gonna get better," I muttered. Sure enough, the other gray suits started doing the same thing. Within seconds, we were completely surrounded by eerie hand mouths, writhing tongues, and dripping slime. Murphy shook her head and sighed. "Ugh. Tell me about it. How long will this thing keep them off?" "They're spirit beings," I said. "As long as the circle's here, they're staying outside it. Couldn't they just scuff dirt on it or something?" I shook my head. Breaking the circle isn't just a physical process. It's an act of choice, of will, and these things don't have that. Murphy frowned. "Then why are they doing anything at all?" I had to restrain myself from smacking my forehead with the heel of my hand. "Because someone summoned them from the Never Never," I said. "Their summoner, wherever he is giving them orders."
"Could he break the circle?" Murphy asked.
"Yeah," I said. "Easily."
"Which is an excellent note upon which to begin our conversation," said a man's voice with a heavy Cockney accent. "Make a hole, lads."
The suits on one side of the circle lowered their hands and stood back, revealing a blocky bulldog of a man in a cheap maroon suit. He was average height, but heavy and solid with muscle, and he wore a few too many extra beers around his middle. His features were blunt and rounded like water-worn stone. His hair was graying and cut into the shortest buzz you could get without going bald, and his eyes were small and hard, and the exact same color as those of the gray suits, a distinctive gray-green.
"Ah, love," said the man, grinning. "I think it's quite fine to see couples who aren't afraid to express their affection for each other."
I blinked at him, then down at Murphy, and realized I was still holding her loosely against me. By the expression on her face, Murph hadn't really taken note of the fact either. She cleared her throat and took a small step back from me, being careful not to step on the circle in the gravel. He nodded at us, still grinning.
"Hello, Dresden. Why not make this easy for all of us and tell me which unit Donald Morgan is hiding in?"
I suddenly realized that I recognized this jerk from the profile the wardens had on him.
"Binder," I said. "That's what they call you, isn't it?"
Binder's smile widened, and he bowed slightly at the waist.
"The same."
Murphy frowned at Binder and said,
"Who is this asshole?"
"One of the guys the wardens wish they could just erase," I said.
"He's a wizard?" "I do have some skills in that direction, love," Binder said.
"He's a one-trick hack," I said, looking directly at him. "Got a talent for calling up things from the Never Never and binding them to his will."
"So, Binder," Murphy said, nodding.
"Yeah, he's scum who sells his talent to the highest bidder, but he's careful not to break any of the laws of magic, so the wardens haven't ever been able to take him down."
"I know," Binder said cheerfully, "and that's why I'm positively savoring the exquisite irony of me being the one to take down the famous warden Donald Morgan, the self-righteous prig."
"You haven't got him yet," I said.
"Matter of time, my lad," Binder said, winking.
He stooped and picked up a single piece of gravel. He bounced it thoughtfully on his palm and eyed us.
"See, there's a bit of competition for this contract, and it's a fair bit of quid. So I'm willing to give you a chance to make my job easier in exchange for considerations."
"What considerations?" I asked. He held up the pebble between his thumb and forefinger.
I won't pitch this into your circle and break it. That way my lads won't need to kill you both. And won't that be nice?
Behind Binder, down at the end of the row of storage units, the dust stirred. Something unseen moved across the gravel. Given how my life had been going, odds were good that it couldn't be a good thing. Unless.
Come on, Binder, I said. Don't be a simp. What makes you think I won't ask the lady here to put a bullet through that empty spot in your head where your brain's supposed to go?
She does that, she lowers the circle, and my lads tear you apart, Binder replied.
That won't be your problem by then, I said.
Binder grinned at me. All of us go down in a blaze of glory, is it?
Murphy calmly raised her gun and settled it on Binder's face. Binder faced her, his grin never fading.
Now, little lady, don't you be doing nothing you'll regret. Without my, personal guidance, my lads here would tear this good gentleman's throat out right quick. But they're considerably less, professional with ladies.
His grin faded.
And you, miss, do not want to know what they're like when they're not professional.
Fingers and slimy tongues and fangs continued pressing against the outer edge of the circle's protective field. Murphy did not let it show on her face, but I saw her shudder.
Decision time, miss, Binder said. Either pull that trigger right now and live with what happens, or put it down like a proper lady and work through this politely.
Murphy's eyes narrowed at his comments.
For all I know, you're about to toss that rock at us. I think I'll keep the gun right where it is.
Bear something else in mind, Binder, I said. I know that you think you can just have your pet step in front of you and throw the rock from behind a wall of them, but think about what happens to you if you kill me.
Your death curse, is it? He asked.
Binder raised his hands and flattened his palms against his cheek in mock horror.
Oh, no, a death curse. Whatever shall I do?
I faced him with a chilly little smile. You'll spend the rest of your life unable to use magic, I think, I said in a quiet, hopefully confident-sounding voice. When I die, I take away your power, forever. No more summoning, no more binding.
Binder's expression began to flatten out into neutrality.
You ever had a job that you liked, Binder? I asked him.
I'm betting you haven't. I've read your file. You're the kind who likes to sleep late, spend a lot of money impressing people, always buys room service, always with the champagne. And you like the women the money gets you.
I shook my head. How many bottles of champagne you think you'll be able to afford when a paper hat becomes part of your professional wear? You've got enough talent to live a nice, long life, man, as a nobody.
He stared at me in silence for a second.
You can't do that, Binder said. Take away my talent. That isn't possible.
I'm a wizard of the White Council, Binder. Not some stupid hack who spent his life using his gift to hurt people. Do you think we go around advertising everything we can do? If you knew half the things I've done that you think are impossible, you'd already be running.
Binder faced me, beads of sweat suddenly standing out on his jowls.
So I'd think real careful before I threw that rock, Binder. Real careful.
A police siren sounded from fairly nearby. I smiled, showing teeth.
Hey, cops, this'll get interesting.
You? He asked incredulously. You'd bring the cops into a private matter?
I pointed a finger sideways at Murphy, who produced her badge and tucked the back of its folder into her belt so that the shield faced Binder.
Already did, Murphy said.
Besides, the whole reason I picked this joint was how heavily the neighborhood was policed, I said. One gunshot and nobody reports anything. Half a dozen and people get nervous.
Binder's eyes narrowed and he looked from us toward the front of the park.
Tick-tock, I said, applying the pressure as hard as I could.
It's just a matter of time, me lad.
Binder looked around him again, then shook his head and sighed.
Balls. It's always messy when I have to deal with the cops. Idiots dying by the truckload, buckets of blood.
He gestured at his men. Identical suspects fleeing in all directions, everyone out chasing them, and more people dying when they managed to catch them.
He stared hard at me.
How about it, wizard? Cop? Maybe you've got stones enough to take it when I threaten you.
I can admire that. My stomach got a little sinking feeling. I'd been counting out seconds, hoping that my nerves didn't make me rush. There should have been enough time by now.
How about those policemen? You willing to have their deaths on your conscience?
He rolled his neck a little, like a prize fighter warming up. Because I'll tell you right now that they aren't going to stop me. I put my hand out and touched Murphy's wrist. She glanced aside at me and then lowered the gun.
That's better, Binder said.
There was no hint of jocularity in his manner now.
All I want is the warden. He's a dead man already, and you know it. What does it matter who takes him?
Something stirred at the end of the row behind Binder, and I started smiling.
I've got no quarrel with you or with this town, Binder continued. Tell me where he is. I'll leave peaceful, and Bob's your uncle.
Murphy drew in a sharp breath. Okay, I said. He's right behind you. Binder's smile, this time, was positively vulpine.
Dresden, we have a bit of banter going between us. We're both here in a moment where neither of us wants to act rashly, and that's all good fun. It's one of the little things that makes a day more enjoyable.
His voice hardened.
But don't do me the incredibly insulting disservice of assuming that I'm a bloody moron.
I'm not, I told him. He's about 40 feet behind you, in a wheelchair. Binder gave me a gimlet stare. Then he rolled his eyes and shot a brief glance over his shoulder, then did a double take as his mouth dropped open. Morgan sat in his wheelchair about 40 feet away from Binder, my shotgun in his hands. Mouse stood beside the chair, focused intently upon Binder and his minions, his body tensed and ready to spring forward.
Hello, Binder, Morgan said in a flat, merciless tone of voice. Now, Miss Carpenter.
Molly appeared out of literally nowhere as she dropped the veil she'd been holding over herself since I'd first seen her moving at the beginning of the conversation with Binder. She was holding my spare blasting rod in her hand, its far end covered with pale dust from being dragged through the gravel. She knelt beside the long, lazy arc of the circle she'd drawn in the dust and touched her hand to it, frowning in concentration. Circles of power are basic stuff, really. Practically anyone can make one if they know how to do it, and learning how to properly establish a circle is the first thing any apprentice is taught. Circles create boundaries that isolate the area inside from the magical energies of the world outside. That's why Binder's minions couldn't cross the plane of the circle I'd drawn on the ground. Their bodies were made up of ectoplasm, held into a solid form by magical energy. The circle cut off that energy when they tried to cross it. As it sprang to life at my apprentice's will, Molly's circle did the same thing as mine, only this time the gray suits were inside it. As the energy field rose up, it cut off the gray suits from the flow of energy they needed to maintain their solid forms. And suddenly, the next best thing to 40 demonic thugs collapsed into splatters of transparent gook. Binder let out a cry as it happened, spinning around desperately, mumbling some kind of incantation under his breath, but he should have saved himself the effort. If he wanted them back, he would have to get out of the isolating field of the enormous circle first, and then he would have to start from scratch.
"Ow, Binder," I said in patently false empathy. "Didn't see that one coming, did you?"
"Ernest Armand Tinwhistle," Morgan thundered in a tone of absolute authority, raising the shotgun to his shoulder. "Surrender yourself or face destruction, you worthless little weasel."
Binder's intense gray-green eyes went from Morgan to the two of us. Then he seemed to reach some kind of conclusion and charged us like a bull, his head down, his arms pumping. Murphy's gun tracked to him, but with a curse, she jerked the barrel up and away from Binder. He slammed a shoulder into her chest, knocking her down, even as I received a stiff arm in the belly. I threw a leg at his as he went by, but I was off balance from the shove, and although I wound up on my ass, I forced him to stumble for a step or three. Murphy took the impact with fluid grace, tumbled onto her back, rolled smoothly over one shoulder, and came back up on her feet.
"Get them out of here,"
she snarled as she spun and took off,
at a sprint after Binder. Mouse came pounding up to my side, staring after Murphy with worried doggy eyes, then glancing at me. "No," I told him. "Watch this." Binder was running as hard as he could, but I doubted he had been all that light on his feet when he was young, much less 20 years and 40 pounds later. Murphy worked out practically every day. She caught him about 10 feet before the end of the row, timed her steps for a second, and then sharply kicked his rearmost leg just as he lifted it to take his next step. His foot got caught on the back of his own calf as a result, and he went down in a sprawl. Binder came to his feet with an explosive snarl of rage and whirled on Murphy. He flung a handful of gravel at her face and then waded in with heavy, looping punches. Murph ducked her head down and kept the gravel out of her eyes, slipped aside from one punch, and then seized his wrist on the second. The two of them whirled in a brief half-circle. Binder let out a yelp, and then his bald head slammed into the steel door of a storage unit. I had to give the guy credit for physical toughness. He rebounded from the door a little woozily, but drove an elbow back at Murphy's head. Murphy caught that arm and continued the motion, using her own body as a fulcrum in a classic hip throw, except that Binder was facing in the opposite direction than usual for that technique. You could hear his arm come out of its socket 50 feet away, and then he hit the gravel face first. Binder got extra points for brains in my book after that. He lay still and didn't put up a struggle as Murphy dragged his wrists behind his back and cuffed him. I traded a glance with Mouse and said, wisely, "Hardcore." The police sirens were getting louder. Murphy looked up at them and then down the row at me. She made an exasperated shooing motion. "Come on," I said to Mouse. The two of us hurried down the row to Morgan's chair. "I couldn't shoot him with this scatterpipe with the two of you standing there," Morgan complained as I approached. "Why didn't you do it?" "That's why," I said, nodding to the park entrance, where a patrol car was screeching to a halt, its blue bubbles flashing. "They get all funny about corpses with gunshot wounds in them." I turned to scowl at Molly. "I told you to bug out at the first sign of danger." She took the handles of Morgan's wheelchair, and we all started back toward the storage unit and its portal. "We didn't know what was going on until we heard them all start shrieking," she protested. "And then Mouse went nuts and started trying to dig his way through a metal door. I thought you might be in trouble, and you were." "That isn't the point," I said. I glanced at the circle drawn in the gravel as we crossed it, breaking it and releasing its power. "Whose idea was the circle?" "Mine," Morgan said calmly. "Circle traps are a standard tactic for dealing with rogue summoners." "I'm sorry it took so long to draw," Molly said, "but I had to make it big enough to get them all." "Not a problem." He was happy to kill time running his mouth. We all entered the storage bay, and I rolled the door closed behind us. "You did good, Grasshopper." Molly beamed. I looked around us and said, "Hey, where's Thomas?"
"The vampire?" Morgan asked.
"I had him watching the outside of the park just in case," I said. Morgan gave me a disgusted look and rolled himself forward toward the prepared portal into the Never Never.
"The vampire goes missing just before a bounty hunter who couldn't possibly know my location turns up. And you're actually surprised, Dresden."
"Thomas called me and told me there was trouble," I said, my voice tight. "If he hadn't, you'd have been drowning in gray suits by now." Molly chewed her lip worriedly and shook her head.
"Harry, I haven't seen him since he dropped us off."
I glanced back toward the entrance of the park, clenching my teeth. Where was he? If he'd been able to do otherwise, Thomas would never have let Murphy and me fight alone against Binder's minions. He would have been right in there beside us. Except he hadn't been. Why not? Had circumstances forced him to leave before I arrived? Or worse, had someone else involved in the current crisis decided to take measures against him? Psycho bitch Madeline came uncomfortably to mind, and the skinwalker had already demonstrated that it was happy to murder my allies instead of striking directly at me. Or maybe he'd simply been overwhelmed by a crowd of gray-suited demons. Maybe his body was already cooling in some nook or cranny of the storage park. My mouth went dry at the thought. Hell's bells. What had happened to my brother? Morgan spoke a quiet word and opened a shimmering rectangular portal in the floor. Molly walked over to it and stared down, impressed.
Dresden, Morgan said, we can't afford to become entangled with the local authorities.
I wanted to scream at him, but he was right. More sirens had closed in on the park. We had to leave. I grabbed the handles to Morgan's chair, started for the portal, and said, let's go, people.
Damn it, Thomas, I snarled to myself. Where the hell are you?
Chapter 20. The portal in my hideaway opened 3 steps from the trail in the Never Never, all right. But those 3 steps weren't handicapped accessible. Molly and I had to each get under one of Morgan's arms and half carry him to the trail. I left Molly and Mouse with him, went back and got the wheelchair, and dragged it up the frozen slope to a path that was all but identical to the one I'd been on earlier. We loaded Morgan into the wheelchair again. He was pale and shaking by the time we were finished. I laid a hand against his forehead. It was hot with fever. Morgan jerked his head away from my fingers, scowling. What is it? Molly asked. She had thought to grab both coats I'd had waiting and had already put one of them on. He's burning up, I said quietly. Butters said that could mean the wound had been infected.
I'm fine, Morgan said, shivering.
Molly helped him into the second coat, looking around at the frozen, haunted wood with nervous eyes. Shouldn't we get him out of the cold then?
Yeah, I said, buttoning my duster shut. It's maybe 10 minutes from here to the downtown portal. Does the vampire know about that, too? Morgan growled.
What's that supposed to mean?
That you'd be walking into an obvious trap, Dresden.
All right, that's it, I snapped. One more comment about Thomas, and you're going body sledding.
Thomas?
Morgan's pale face turned a little darker as he raised his voice.
How many corpses is it going to take to make you come to your senses, Dresden?
Molly swallowed. Harry, excuse me? Both of us glared at her. She flushed and avoided eye contact. Isn't this the Never Never?
Yeah,
I said.
Obviously, Morgan said at the same time.
We faced each other again, all but snarling. Okay, Molly said. Haven't you told me that it's sort of dangerous? She took a deep breath and hurried her speech. I mean, you know, isn't it sort of dumb to be standing here arguing in loud voices? All things considered? I suddenly felt somewhat foolish. Morgan's glower waned. He bowed his head wearily, folding his arms across his belly.
Yeah, I said, reining in my own temper. Yeah, probably so. Not least because anyone who comes through the ways from Edinburgh to Chicago is going to walk right over us, Morgan added.
Molly nodded, which would be sort of awkward. I snorted quietly. I nodded my head in the proper direction and started pushing the wheelchair down the trail. This way. Molly followed, her eyes darting left and right at the sounds of movement in the fairy wood around us. Mouse fell into pace beside her, and she reached down to lay a hand on the dog's back as she walked, an entirely unconscious gesture. We moved at a steady pace and in almost complete silence for maybe 5 minutes before I said, we need to know how they found out about you.
The vampire is the best explanation, Morgan replied, his tone carefully neutral.
I have information about him that you don't, I said. Suppose it isn't him. How did they do it?
Morgan pondered that for a time. Not with magic.
You certain?
Yes,
he sounded like it. Your countermeasures are that good? I asked.
Yes.
I thought about that for a minute. Then it dawned on me what Morgan had done to protect himself from supernatural discovery. You called in your marker, the silver oak leaf, the one Titan. I forced myself to stop, glancing uneasily around the fairy forest, the one the Summer Queen awarded you. Morgan turned his head slightly to glance at me over his shoulder. I whistled. I'd seen Queen Titania with my sight once. The tableau of Titania and her counterpart, Mab, preparing to do battle with each other, still ranked as the most humbling and awe-inspiring display of pure power I had ever witnessed.
That's why you're so certain no one is going to find you. She's the one shielding you.
I admit, Morgan said, with another withering look, it's no donut.
I scowled. How'd you know about that?
Titania's retainer told me. The entire summer court has been laughing about it for months.
Molly made a choking sound behind me. I didn't turn around. It would just force her to put her hand over her mouth to hide the smile.
How long did she give you? I asked.
Sundown, tomorrow.
36 hours, give or take. A few hours more than I believed I'd had, but not much.
Do you have the oak leaf on you?
Of course, he said. May I see it?
Morgan shrugged and drew a leather cord from around his neck. A small leather pouch hung from the cord. He opened it, felt around inside, and came out with it. A small, exquisitely detailed replica of an oak leaf, backed with a simple pin. He held it out to me. I took it and pitched it into the haunted wood.
Morgan actually did growl this time.
Why?
Because the Summer Queen bugged them. Last year, her goon squad was using mine to track me down all over Chicago.
Morgan frowned at me and glanced out toward where I'd thrown it. Then he shook his head and rubbed tiredly at his eyes with one hand.
Must be getting senile. Never even considered it.
I don't get it, Molly said. Isn't he still protected anyway?
He is, I said, but that leaf isn't. So if the Summer Queen wants him found, or if someone realizes what she's doing and makes her a deal, she can keep her word to Morgan to hide him and give him away. All she has to do is make sure someone knows to look for the spell on the oak leaf.
The she are only bound to the letter of their agreements, Morgan said, nodding, which is why one avoids striking bargains with them unless there are no options.
So Binder could have been following the oak leaf? Molly asked.
I shrugged.
Maybe. It is still entirely possible that the Summer Queen is dealing in good faith, Morgan said.
I nodded.
Which brings us back to the original question. How did Binder find you?
Well, Molly said, not to mince words, but he didn't.
He would have found us in a matter of moments, Morgan said.
That's not what I mean, she said. He knew you were in the storage park, but he didn't know which unit, exactly. I mean, wouldn't tracking magic have led him straight to you? And if Thomas sold you out, wouldn't he have told Binder exactly which storage bay we were in?
Morgan started to reply, then frowned and shut his mouth.
Hmph.
I glanced over my shoulder at the grasshopper and gave her a nod of approval.
Molly beamed at me.
Someone on the ground following us? Morgan asked.
A tailing car wouldn't have been able to enter the storage park without a key.
I thought of how I'd been shadowed by the skinwalker the previous evening.
If they're good enough, it would be possible, I admitted. Not likely, but possible.
So? Morgan said. Where does that leave us?
Baffled, I said.
Morgan bared his teeth in a humorless smile.
Where to next, then?
If I take you back to my place, they'll pick us up again, I said. If someone's using strictly mortal methods of keeping track of our movements, they'll have someone watching it.
Morgan looked back and up at me.
I assume you aren't just going to push me in circles around Chicago while we wait for the council to find us.
No, I said. I'm taking you to my place.
Morgan thought about that for a second, then nodded sharply.
Right.
Where the bad guys will see us and send someone else to kill us, Molly said. No wonder I'm the apprentice, because I'm so ignorant that I can't see why that isn't a silly idea.
Watch and learn, Grasshopper. Watch and learn.
Chapter 21. We left the trail again, and for the second time in a day, I emerged from the Never Never into the alley behind the old meatpacking plant. We made two stops and then walked until we could flag down another cab. The cabbie didn't seem to be overly thrilled with Mouse, or the wheelchair, or how we filled up his car, but maybe he just didn't speak enough English to ably convey his enthusiasm. You never know.
These really aren't good for you, Molly said through a mouthful of donut as we unloaded the cab.
It's Morgan's fault he started talking about donuts, I said. And besides, you're eating them.
I have the metabolic rate of youth, Molly said, smiling sweetly. You're the one who needs to start being health conscious, O venerable mentor. I'll be invincible for another year or two, at least. We wrestled Morgan into his chair, and I paid off the cabbie. We rolled Morgan over to the steps leading down to my apartment, and between the two of us, managed to turn his chair around and get him down the stairs and into the apartment without dropping him. After that, I grabbed Mouse's lead, and the two of us went up to get the mail from my mailbox, and then to amble around to the boarding house's small backyard and the patch of sandy earth set aside for Mouse's use. But instead of loitering around waiting for Mouse, I led him into the far corner of the backyard, which is a miniature jungle of old lilacs that hadn't been trimmed or pruned since Mr. Spunklecreef died. They were in bloom, and their scent filled the air. Bees buzzed busily about the bushy plants, and as I stepped closer to them, the corner of the building cut off the traffic sounds. It was the only place on the property's exterior that was not readily visible from most of the rest of the buildings on the street. I pressed past the outer branches of the lilacs and found a small and relatively open space in the middle. Then I waited. Within seconds, there was a buzzing sound, like the wings of a particularly large dragonfly, and then a tiny winged fairy darted through the lilacs to come to a halt in front of me. He was simply enormous for a pixie, one of the wee folk, and stood no less than a towering 12 inches high. He looked like an athletically built youth, dressed in an odd assortment of armor made from discarded objects and loose ends. He'd replaced his plastic bottle cap helmet with one made of most of the shell of a hollowed-out golf ball. It was too large for his head, but that didn't seem to concern him. His cuirass had first seen service as a bottle of Pepto-Bismol, and hanging at his hip was what looked like the blade to a jigsaw, with one end wrapped in string to serve as a grip. Wings, like those of a dragonfly, buzzed in a translucent cloud of motion at his back. The little fairy came to attention in midair, snapped off a crisp salute, and said,
"Mission accomplished, my lord of pizza!"
"That fast?" I asked. It hadn't been 20 minutes since I'd first summoned him, after we'd gotten donuts and before we'd gotten into the cab. "Quick work, Toot-Toot, even for you." The praise seemed to please the little guy immensely. He beamed and buzzed in a couple of quick circles.
"He's in a building across the street from this one. 2 buildings toward the lake."
I grunted, thinking. If I was remembering right, that was another boarding house converted into apartments, like mine. The white one with green shutters?
"Yes. That's where the rapscallion has made his lair."
His hand flashed to his waist, and he drew his saw-toothed sword from its transparent plastic scabbard, scowling fiercely.
"Shall I slay him for you, my lord?"
I very carefully kept the smile off of my face. "I don't know if things have escalated to that level just yet," I said. "How do you know this guy is watching my apartment?"
Oh, don't tell me this one!"
Toot jittered back and forth in place, bobbing in excitement.
"Because he has curtains on the windows so you can't see in. And then there's a big black plastic box with a really long nose poking through them, and a glass eye on the end of the nose. And he looks at the back of it all the time, and when he sees someone going into your house, he pushes a button, and the box beeps."
"Camera, huh?" I asked. "Yeah, that probably makes him our snoop." I squinted up at the summer sunshine and adjusted the uncomfortably warm leather duster. I wasn't taking it off, though. There was too much hostility flying around for that. "How many of your kin are about, Toot?"
"Hundreds,"
Toot-Toot declared, brandishing his sword.
"Thousands."
I arched an eyebrow. "You've been splitting the pizza 1,000 ways?
"Well, Lord," he amended. "Several dozen, at any rate."
The wee folk are a fractious, fickle bunch, but I've learned a couple of things about them that I'm not sure anyone else knows. First, that they're just about everywhere, and anywhere they aren't, they can usually get. They don't have much of an attention span, but for short, simple tasks, they are hell on wheels. Second, they have a lust for pizza that is without equal in this world. I've been bribing the wee folk with pizza on a regular basis for years, and in return, they've given me their, admittedly erratic, loyalty. They call me the Zaw Lord, and the little fair folk who take my pizza also serve in the Zaw Lord's guard, which means, mostly, that the wee folk hang around my house hoping for extra pizza and protecting it from wee threats. Toot Toot was their leader, and he and his folks had pulled off some very helpful tasks for me in the past. They had saved my life on more than one occasion. No one in the supernatural community ever expected everything of which they were capable. As a result, Toot and his kin are generally ignored. I try to take that as a life lesson. Never underestimate the little people. This was a job that was right up Toot Toot's alley, almost literally. "Do you know which car is his?" I asked. Toot threw back his head, Yul Brynner style.
"Of course! The blue one with this on the hood!"
He threw his arms out and up at an angle and stood ramrod straight in a Y shape. "Blue Mercedes, huh?" I asked. "Okay, here's what I want you to do." 5 minutes later, I walked back around the side of the house to the front opposite the street. Then I turned to face the house where the snoop was set up and put on my most ferocious scowl. I pointed directly at the curtained second-floor windows, then turned my hand over and crooked my finger, beckoning. Then I pointed to the ground right in front of me. One of the curtains might have twitched. I gave it a slow count of 5 and then started walking briskly toward the other boarding house, crossing the busy street in the process. A young man in his 20s, wearing khaki shorts and a green T-shirt, came rushing out of the converted boarding house and ran toward a blue Mercedes parked on the street, an expensive camera hanging around his neck. I kept walking, not changing my pace. He rushed around to the driver's door, pointing some kind of handheld device at the car. Then he clawed at the door, but it stayed closed. He shot another glance at me and then tried to insert his key into the lock. Then he blinked and stared at his key as he pulled it back, trailing streamers of a rubbery pink substance, bubblegum. "I wouldn't bother," I said as I got closer. "Look at the tires." The young man glanced from me to his Mercedes and stared some more. All 4 tires were completely flat. "Oh," he said. He looked at his gum-covered key and sighed. "Well, shit." I stopped across the car from him and smiled faintly. "Don't feel too bad about it, man. I've been doing this longer than you." He gave me a sour look, then he held up his key. "Bubblegum?" "Could have been super glue. Take it as a professional courtesy." I nodded toward his car. "Let's talk. Turn the air conditioning on, for crying out loud." He eyed me for a moment and sighed. "Yeah, okay." We both got in the car. He scraped the gum off his key and put it in the ignition, but when he turned it, nothing happened. "Oh, pop the hood," I said. He eyed me and did. I went around to the front of the car and reconnected the loose battery cable. I said, "Okay," and he started the engine smoothly. Like I said, give Toot Toot and his kin the right job, and they are formidable as hell. I got back in the car and said, "You licensed?" The young man shrugged and turned his AC up to deep freeze. "Yeah," I nodded. "How long?" "Not long." "Cop?" "In Joliet," he said. "But not now. Didn't fit." "Why are you watching my place?" He shrugged. "I got a mortgage." I nodded and held out my hand. "Harry Dresden." He frowned at the name. "You the one used to work for Nick Christian at Ragged Angel?" "Yeah." "Nick has a good reputation." He seemed to come to some kind of conclusion and took my hand with a certain amount of resignation. "Vince Graver." "You got hired to snoop on me?" He shrugged. "You tail me last night?" "You know the score, man," Graver said. "You take someone's money, you keep your mouth shut." I lifted my eyebrows. A lot of PIs wouldn't have the belly to be nearly so reticent under the circumstances. It made me take a second look at him. Thin, built like someone who ran or rode a bicycle on his weekends. Clean cut without being particularly memorable. Medium brown hair, medium height, medium brown eyes. The only exceptional thing about his appearance was that there was nothing exceptional about his appearance. "You keep your mouth shut," I agreed. "Until people start getting hurt. Then it gets complicated." Graver frowned. "Hurt?" "There have been 2 attempts on my life in the past 24 hours, I said. "Do the math." He focused his eyes down the street into the distance and pursed his lips. Damn.
Damn?
He nodded morosely. There goes the rest of my fees and expenses.